Flux, season 5 of the Telly Award-winning podcast. Come you like one Winston J. Wolf. If we're curt with you, it's because time is a factor. We think fast, we talk fast, and you guys are going to have to act fast if you want to get out of this. So pretty please, with sugar on top, listen to the fucking podcast. I am Ryland Grant, screenwriter, Ringo Award-winning creator of fine picks like Aberrant, Man Jackson, The Jump, The Other Voice in the Dark, The Man in the Box to the Left is...
David Avalone, writer, coffee achiever, freshly shaved.
Freshly shaved. You do look freshly shaved. Your mustache is looking quite magnificent today.
It's all under control.
Yeah, my video is a little choppy. Are you still hearing me okay?
Your audio is fine. The video is a little jumpy, but I think we can.
Video is choppy. Yeah, well, okay.
I have shaving cream in my ear, so that's good. That's a good thing.
Yeah, well, maybe we need Winston J. Wolf to come in and fix my internet. But if you missed any of our previous conversations episodes featuring comic luminaries like David F. Walker, Matt Fraction, Stan Sakai, Kevin Eastman, Robbie Barnes, and many, many more, our entire catalog will be celebrated via YouTube, Apple Pods, and other purveyors of worthwhile ear crack. So double on back and check all that out. We have an incredible show for you today. Great guest. But let's do a little house cleaning before we legitimize this thing. What do you got for us this week, Avalone?
I don't know what I got this week. I don't think I have any books coming out this week. No, week from now, I think, should be either and or Elvira meets H.P. Lovecraft 5. Okay. What Stan Lee would call an all-action, senses-shattering-ish. Yeah. And Drawing Blood number 3, which has some action, but is mostly existential angst as our hero goes to the funeral of his mentor and best friend and is threatened by Lithuanian gangsters, as happens.
Oh, nice.
What do you got going on?
As happens. Yeah, two movies in theaters, if you still remember what those are and where they are, and if you still go to those things. Not too many people do that, but State of Consciousness is an interesting, challenging sci-fi romp, and Haunted Heart is a, kind of a love story turned paranoid thriller. So check those out if they're near you and when they're near you. The Peacekeepers 3 and 4 headed your way soon if you guys ordered those, so get ready for those. And new book announcement pretty soon, so stay tuned. I could tell you, but I'd have to kill you. I'm a little too sure. Busy and interesting and all that stuff, but let's quit yapping and let's get our guest on.
Ladies and gentlemen and nerds at home, Chris Ryle joining
hello
us.
Hello,
hey Chris. Howdy. Good to see
you. Hey guys, I will do my best to match Ryland's energy level, but I'll probably end up coming in somewhere more akin to David's.
I
need burnout at the beginning, otherwise I'll just be yelling the entire time. So it'll turn into a Guy Fieri situation. So I expect the energy early and we'll have a normal conversation. So
yeah.
Either way, great to be talking to you guys.
Yeah, well, Chris, tell the kids at home a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I'm a writer, editor, publisher. I currently have my own imprint at Image Comics called Syzygy Publishing.
Nice. Speaking of things we learned from comic books, I learned how to pronounce Syzygy, and I learned what it was because I had to look it up when Jim Starlin named the wizard in Dreadstar Syzygy Darklock.
I did neither of those things. I think I said Syzygy in my head as I read that book, but that was my first exposure to the word anyway, but I never even looked it up. I was like, all right, that's a weird name. I feel like
there was a letter column where Archie Goodwin explained how to pronounce it and what it was. So it may be that Archie Goodwin, legendary comics editor and writer, explained what a Syzygy was to me. It's when the planets line up, kids at home, just so that we're not leaving out crucial pieces of information.
Nice. Which, when brought it up as a name of the imprint, I was like, nobody's going to be able to spell it or pronounce it or define it. And so when I looked up the definition and saw the whole thing about planets in alignment, I was like, well, I could wrap my head around the definition working with a couple creators, making books together. But yeah, for the most part, I was told that the name was not good.
Well, sometimes you got to ignore that kind of advice.
Yeah, Ash likes strange words, and I like indulging Ash, and I like it. So It worked for us.
Yeah. It was the suggestion of a partner?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Well, good to hear that. I think it would be cool to start with the origin story a little bit and how you ended up as an editor. Because when I met you, you were primarily doing that over at IDW.
Yeah, my first job in comics was IDW's editor-in-chief, which is an odd way to break in, I realize. But, you know, the more you talk to anybody in comics, like, everybody's break-in story is different. It's not like doctor or lawyer where there's a path. It's all like we kind of trip and stumble and fall and beg and all that, and suddenly you land and hope it's a sustainable thing. And so my path to comics was like, I was a technical writer. I was writing advertising copy. Okay. So I always wanted to be a writer of some sort. I didn't know how to break into comics. I thought you typed up scripts, you mailed them in manila envelopes to New York, and then they got tossed into a shredder. If you couldn't like stop by the Marvel or DC offices. And so I didn't have any sort of path that I knew to follow. So I started writing comic reviews online. That led me to being in conversation with Kevin Smith about some things. At the start, it was because he took exception to one of my reviews, but then it eventually went amicable. He hired me to run a website for him. That was,
oh, that's nice.
Yeah. What, and it was
movie what did you review? What did you review harshly? I have to know.
And, you know, I was never one of those guys that like talked garbage about a book. I didn't understand Green Arrow number one, the one he did with Phil Hester, because, you know, he was doing a story like at that point in the continuity, Green Arrow was dead. He basically pulled him from the past into this comic. And so when I read it, I didn't know the backstory of where it was headed. I just like, this character is such an anachronism at this point. Like, he's using phrases from the 60s, you know, it didn't work for me as the first issue. And Kevin said, your opinion is wrong. And I said, well, no, it's my opinion. And so we sort of like went back and forth on it. And then it got more amicable. And he finally said, you know, I like you. I want to hire you to run this website of my movie Poop Shoot. It was an Ain't It Cool News parody site in one of my movies. I want you to turn it into a legitimate like Variety meets Bleeding Cool meets, you know, comic and film and TV and music news. And, you know, to some degree, we were saddled with a challenging name when you're trying to get legitimacy in the media.
Yeah.
But I think we took it seriously and treated it, you know, and brought in good writers and we didn't do any sort of trash talking or the way they used it in the movie. We sort of treated it legitimately and it became a real thing. Through that, I got to meet comic book people. And Steve Niles was probably the most prominent in that regard that led me to IDW because he was IDW's big writer at the time. You know, in their early days, he called me at one point and said, hey, would you ever consider taking the editor-in-chief job at IDW? It's coming available. And I was an advertising copywriter for my real job, but my side job was editor-in-chief at Kevin's site. And so the website editor-in-chiefing was kind of what gave me the prime sort of background and experience level to then lead me into IDW. And so the weird thing is, as we're talking today, is the 22nd year since Movie Poop Shoot launched, and it's also like would be my 20th anniversary of my start at IDW. So good time to be talking about these things.
Okay, so you would. I didn't realize you were that long at IDW. That's great.
Yeah, I was there from 2004 to about 2020. With there's a 1 year excursion where I left and went to Skybound for a year.
I remember.
And then I went back as president and publisher and chief creative officer. And then ultimately just moved on in mid 2020.
Sure.
I'm sitting here giggling like a teenager because it's such a, I mean, we hear a lot of origin stories on this program and it's funny. Well, it all started with something called Movie Poop Shoot. It's very good. And then it turns into this very prolific comic book career. It's funny.
The funny thing is at Kevin's other website, Kevin Smith's website, View Askew, there was always a note that was like, do not try to get jobs through online. Do not, you know, it was like the way that I found my way into his site and then into comics was sort of on their site as a thing that you should never do because it will never work. And so,
right.
You know, you never know. I mean, we tell people try stuff. Yeah.
Let's be serious. And this is something that I always talk about with networking in particular, because I'm obsessed with how misunderstood it is as a concept. you weren't trying to get a job from Kevin Smith when you insulted his writing in the first issue of a comic book. That's the story here. You weren't coming to Kevin Smith saying, you weren't trying to get noticed. You weren't trying to do anything other than write a review of a comic book that you found confusing. But in further interactions, you guys became friends and he developed a respect for you. And to me, as unusual as your origin story is, that part of it is every origin story. You weren't particularly like doing the thing as a networking thing. You were just expressing. I mean, it's the same. I think Gail Simone has this actually similar entrance to it. You know, she wrote an article for a way, you know, she wrote comedy articles about comic books on a website and someone decided, hey, maybe she should write a comic book. You know?
Yeah, and it's funny because Matt Singer and I did that at another website. We were writing like Onion type of parody news articles. And, you know, Matt Singer's gone on to become a great movie reviewer. He had that recent book about Siskel and Ebert that was a bestseller. And so it's fun just sort of watching all the people that did the stuff that way at the time who have now gone on to actually find other ways into the medium and you know,
and all kinds I feel of like, ways. I mean, maybe it's only one of them and I'm conflating them, but it like, don't Kurt Busiek and Mark Waid start out as guys writing like, or just all over the letter columns?
Oh my God. There are so many letter columns. I mean, if you look back, like
you go back and look at any issue of an old comic, you're like, oh, here's a letter from Kurt.
I mean, wait.
He's talking about how much he didn't like X-Men 137 and how, you know, he just didn't really love the Byrne, Claremont run and everything, which I just find amusing. I mean, and you know, like when I reviewed Kevin's comic, like we had salient points of why these things didn't work. It wasn't like trash talking, like kind of online commentary has become. It was, it was very much taking it seriously, but just why it didn't land well for us. But you know, there's a history of that back to like Marv Wolfman and Paul Levitz, you know, writing fanzines back before they broke into
That's comics, true.
So.
Wasn't Joe Duffy another letter column person?
Oh yeah, Gene Simmons was Gene Simmons partner with Marv Wolfman on his fanzine before you know he went another route entirely. But just this that people kind of find their way in, you know, because all of us start as fans of something, right? Like it's sort of our fandom and our love of what other people have done that made us like the
medium. There's not enough money in this for us to be like venture capitalists.
Right. Yeah.
Who became comic book writers and editors. That is, we are never going to, that's the one good thing. The one thing we have over the film industry, over tech, is that we will not, no one with a business degree wants any part of this.
No, in fact, when they come in and they try to do things, like we've all got our hackles up about it. Like, well, what are their intentions? You know, the Virgin Comics or the Radical, you know, the ones that are such blatant IP developers for film that we're like, if you don't love the medium, it's not going to come across well to fans and it's just not ultimately going to work.
And it inevitably fails. I mean, it's not like we're all like, oh, and then this guy that completely didn't understand the medium had a big hit. It's like, not really. It's not really a thing that happens in this industry.
Yeah, I love that plan. I mean, nobody's ever gotten rich making comics, and I just love that. It's one company every two or three years that's like the plan. We're gonna get rich making comics. You know.
A sense of like something works, right? So something eventually gets made without any acknowledgement that the book was a comic book for 10 years or whatever before it got on air. Yeah. And so then they go, well, just do that. Just make the hits over and over. Like we're not doing that by choice, you know? Like if we knew the formula to make a book that was a bestseller, like we'd probably follow it.
Yeah. Well, it's one of two things, right? It's either like, okay, this became an overnight success over the course of 12 years or whatever. There's that story, which is very common. Or it is a lottery ticket situation. And seriously, like this, you know, Silicon Valley bro who wants to, you know, kick his way into comic book and get rich, like he might as well just drive to Vegas and just put it all on black. Like that, it's probably a better use of with you know, with time and the passion that you will be willing to put into this. Like, sincerely, that is a better bet. That is a better use of your time. It is a better use of your capital. Put it back. Right? Roll the dice. If I can.
But we also don't want to say that too loudly because you know every now and then, like a bunch of creators could benefit from the influx of speculator cash. So.
Absolutely. Yeah. I at the Sorry beginning of the streaming video phenomenon. there were like four or five incredibly overfunded streamers, which you may or may not remember. Atom Films, Digital Entertainment Network. And I went with a small website called Bijou Cafe that had very little money, had no venture capital, but I ended up owning my film, and you know, I have them back now and all that. And there is the part of me that goes, you know, would it have been so bad to take a dumb big check for a bunch of idiots to own my film for about 5 years and not know what to do with it? And, you know, and every single one of those stories, I feel like every one of the 1999 through 2003 digital streamers online, every single one was like, yeah, we were doing a lot of blow and we all bought yachts and nobody really got around to making any films because we had conned a bunch of VC idiots into backing our next thing. I mean, there was a site, I can't even remember what it was called. There was a site that was going to have short films from Spielberg and Ron Howard. And I can't even remember what that site
was. That wasn't Quibi, was it?
No, this is decades
way back.
Yeah. But the stories with these things are always funny because Quibi is such an interesting story where it was like Quibi had a lot of money and they're just throwing money at people. However, you know, so Quibi, really great talent, but that talent did not want to waste their good ideas on Quibi. So yeah. Quibi threw a ton of money at all these great filmmakers and Quibi got their like sixth or seventh or 10th best idea. And it's like, okay, well, I'll take a huge paycheck to kind of make this thing and put it on auto and all. It ended up being kind of garbage.
It kind of sums up like the misunderstanding that these guys have of all kinds of entertainment, you know, comics, film, whatever it is like,
yep.
The reason people liked short entertainment was because it was made by people like them. You know, it's kind of like Webtoons. Webtoons fans aren't looking for licensed content. The people that like watching TikTok like it because it's just individuals making stuff and not Jeffrey Katzenberg making stuff with his highfalutin friends. Like, there's always just kind of the groundswell thing is a thing we could do better because we're professionals. Like, well, that's kind of not what people want in that form. And so, right. It's kind of the push-pull that's been there forever, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, and it is also, there was a, you know, you can almost go back to Bob Dylan with the people would rather have authentic than good. Like the man can't sing to save his life. That's, you know, but we've all loved him for decades because the lyrics are really good and he plays well. And people would rather there's a shift in entertainment where people are like, yeah, but Frank Sinatra's not writing any of that stuff. And, he's selling it. Presley isn't writing any of it. And it all becomes like, no, what we want is what's the line? Authenticity. If you can fake that, you've got it made.
Right.
There's also this fundamental problem where they feel like they need to like remake the experience. You know, I mean, the whole beat is a little ridiculous where it's like in the future, everybody's going to watch TV and films only on their phones. And we're going to be on the cutting edge. You see in comics all the time where it's like, I mean, how many different kinds of like motion comic type things have we seen? We're going to come in and revolutionize this and people aren't going to want to read regular comics because they're going to want the comics to move and they're going to want to, it feels like there was a new one of those, maybe two every year or something like that.
We experimented with a lot of them at IDW. We tried because we were able to pivot more because we didn't have sort of the corporation behind us on, you know, the stuff that we own, 30 Days a Night or what, Zombies versus Robots. Like, we could try all these motion comics, but all we did in the 21st century, the early 21st century, was find a way to replicate the 1960s Marvel animated cart, you know, just like, cut up.
You end up with the Marvel comics
and sort of shape them. And
that thing, Rylan, that you said earlier about people giving you like their fifth best thing on a thing like Quibi. Someone came to me once trying to get their hands on some licensed material that I own, my dad's books, for a motion comic type thing. And one of their big exciting things was like, Shatner has given us Tech War.
Yeah, love it so much.
And I was like, that's literally the nail in the coffin on this conversation. Shatner has given you his out of print books that he's not doing anything with. What a big thing for him to do.
Yeah. Why don't you just take these?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not doing anything.
Shatner probably wrote as much of Tech War as Trump wrote of The Art of the Deal. You know what I mean? You see that in comics now too. And like, I don't begrudge anybody making any kind of paycheck they can in comics because I was talking to Jam DeMatteis about this morning, and he sort of referred to like the freelance comic life as dancing on quicksand. And so again, I don't begrudge it, but you do see sort of the same names associated with a lot of different comic startups. And you do get a sense that some are like, I'm not going to give you my A-list stuff. You're going to get my fifth or 10th idea over here.
I'm telling you, Stripperella is going to be the next Spider-Man.
Stripperella.
Yeah, well, Stan probably had other reasons for getting into that business too. I don't
know. Oh, yes, I'm sure. But it's just, it's, you know, when you engage the creator of so many great comic books, and that's what he brings you.
Before I got into the movie Poop Shoot thing and then onward into comics, like I worked for Dick Clark Productions up in Burbank, and one of our clients, and one of the reasons I took the job was for Stanley Media, to, you know, a chance to work directly with Stan. And it was all the like Seventh Portal characters, which were like, everything was like a cosmic skateboard and like just kind of not necessarily the freshest of ideas, let's say.
Yeah.
It's really good.
But again, I love, really good. You know, I have a great fondness for a certain brand of mid-century huckster. And, you know, and Stan is like, you know, I will argue forever that that kind of cheerleader is something comics always needs.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we had Stan, we had Mark Miller, you know, everybody sort of finds their way to like hype stuff to a degree that gets people excited. And we need excitement in this business. Like there, I think that's probably one of the challenges right now is there's not a ton of like excitement in everybody's, you know, just the way they talk about comics. It's more of like taking shots at the business instead of finding the stuff that gets them excited, which is, like, I always want to just find the stuff that I'm positive about and that I feel good recommending. I, you know, if I don't like something, I don't need to tell the world.
Yeah, that's, you know, do you know the Jonathan Gold principle? He was the legendary restaurant reviewer for the LA Times. He never gave a bad review. And partly in his specific case, it was because he's like the only, like the one of the most famous restaurant reviewers in the world. And he's like, I don't need to destroy someone's business because I didn't enjoy a salad. Like I don't need to pick on some struggling. Like I know how hard it is to keep a restaurant open. If I go to a restaurant and have a bad experience, I don't need to talk about it. And you can judge by like people are perfectly willing to like, oh, he's never reviewed that restaurant. I wonder why. You can do that kind of deductive reasoning all day, but I do the same thing, particularly the older I get. I'm like, I don't need to trash talk people's work in public, particularly indie creators. It's just not.
Yeah, everybody's trying to make stuff that they love, you know, and it doesn't always land for everyone. It doesn't have to.
Yeah.
And how much time and effort does it take to write a bad review? You know, you will read an evisceration sometimes. And you can just see the hours of work and all of the, you know, all of the like evil heart and soul that was poured into this thing. And it's like, well, you know, really you are a powerful person. You could have used this power for good. Like the world could be, you could have spent that 2 or 3 hours making the world a better place. Even if like, hey, here's this book that, you know, too few people know about. Let's point a spotlight at it. Right. Right. And it's really a matter of, we only have so much bandwidth, we only have resources. So what do you want to do with that? And it is the thing, Chris, that really interests me, you know, about this imprint created at Image, where it was like, it kind of seems like that's what you've done, is that you have, you know, you only have so much bandwidth. Only so many chips to put on the table, and you've done it very carefully. Where it's like, these are creators I like; these are stories I wanted to tell. Let me get a bunch of people together, and let's put some good projects out in the world. You know.
Well, I have to say that was like one of the most professional ways of recentering the conversation and giving us back on
very well
like,
done.
Beautifully done. Yeah. thank you. Like, the hard part is when people ask me like, "What is Syzygy?" or "What are you looking for?" How do I pitch you? And I don't know how to define it. Like, I don't have a very encapsulated sort of take on like, here's what we are. It's more of just like, I want to do books with creators that I like, creators that I either want to give more voice to, or I think are deserving of more attention, or just have a sort of different and more idiosyncratic take on something. Cause there's a lot of parody in what comic publishers are doing now. And so I'm sort of striving to find books that don't necessarily feel like they would be at home at 10 other places. And I mean, it's hard to do because it's all very taste driven, but that's sort of my underlying goal, is like, is it a little weird? If it's a little weird, then I feel like we should look at it. And so again, like it's kind of the no a-hole rule and just like what's appealing to us, what kind of hits on, like, me and Ashley Wood, my partner, have sort of odd sensibilities at times. And, you know, we don't take ourselves or our books overly seriously. And so it's trying to find other stuff that we think sort of does that, or just has something kind of unique to say, or a unique look and feel to it, that kind of thing. So yeah, anyway, thank you for sort of summing it up that way.
How many books do you have currently coming from Syzygy?
You know, it varies between 1 to 3 titles a month. Some of it, I've also been republishing some of the things I did at IDW, just as a way to either put new eyes on it, get it out there in a new format, and also just what sort of I'm able to manage bandwidth-wise and honestly financially-wise, because I think everybody that's doing independent comics has sort of the financial ebb and flow of what's workable. So then you end up doing other things to help sort of fund the stuff you like. And so there's fair amounts of that here and there. So yeah, anyway, it's between 1 and 3 books a month, I think, is what's been comfortable. It's hard, man. I for everybody that's doing this, like, I had a staff around me. And so I don't think I realized how difficult making comics as a solo act or a very small team really is. And so I fully appreciate
it's one of the things. It's one of the reasons I encourage creators to do Kickstarters. Mm. Not that I think we should all have great sympathy for massive corporations, but man, you put a floppy on the stands, you get a real taste of how psychotic the margins are in this business. And you go, I have to pay them what to do that? Oh, Jesus. Like, they take that much? Okay. Like, once you start whittling away, forget the budget. You know, what Diamond takes, what the store takes, what, you know, what the printing and shipping. And then you're like, how does anything make money in this business? It's sort of like, you know, I always say making a good movie, I compare it to hitting a home run. If you describe it accurately, it sounds like the most impossible thing in the world. Someone's going to throw something at you that's about 2 inches across. They're throwing it at you at 95 miles an hour. You have to swing a 2-inch wide piece of wood in an arc that's going to connect with it in exactly the way that'll send it 450 feet.
Yeah.
That does not sound like a thing that anyone could actually do, but people do it every day. It's, you know, if you break down making a comic book, you're like, no, that's unlikely.
You know, and like with baseball, like if we actually get 1 out of every 3 books we produce as a hit, like, that's a great track record, exactly. But it's 300 also really
is an amazing batting average in comic books, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All the fame stuff. I love the mandate you're talking about, because I think it's so interesting. I mean, when you come from a bigger label, something like IDW, you are taking those interesting, you know, pushing into the corners and stuff like that. There were those books. But then there's a lot of books where it's like, well, these are going to make us some money. These are, you know, these are our foundational books. These keep the lights on, right? And there's a balance, right? And just this idea, I mean, what I like about the mandate of this imprint is what drew me to comics is that, you know, I mean, I wrote movies, I wrote action movies for 12 years before I ever did a comic book, and Hollywood makes like 5 different kinds of action movies. You know, and they want them all written, you know, they want them all written a certain way. And so it's all vanilla ice cream. Right. And so there's a ton of vanilla ice cream in a theater, on a streamer, all of these things. And I got really good at making vanilla ice cream, in my house, but it is not interesting. And what drew me to comics is like, well, you can tell any kind of story you want. You can tell it any way you want. The more challenge, better. As long as it's good, you will find an audience for it. People will celebrate you for it. And that was what pulled me in. And so that is what I see, man, that is what I see in your books now, and your label is like, well, okay, well, we don't need any more vanilla ice cream in the marketplace, right? So let's give them Rocky Road, let's give them Chocolate, let's push into these corners, and let's make books that are interesting and challenging, right? Let's see what this medium can be.
And you're absolutely right. In a vacuum, the thing that a lot of companies don't understand is it's a real simple formula for this stuff, which the way we did it back in the day was you do the licenses, you do the Star Treks and Transformers because they sell well. Turtles sells well. Yeah. And that stuff, it's sort of like Fox and Fox Searchlight. You know, you make the big tentpole movies because that funds the more riskier stuff. So doing Transformers and Star Trek allows us to take shots on Lock and Key, which at the time, you know, Joe Hill was an unproven author, certainly in the comic space. And the title was unknown. And so you don't know if that's going to work. And it's a fair investment to even launch a book like that and to stick with it and sort of let it build an audience. And so you need those other things that, like you say, help keep the lights on. So that's what I haven't figured out post IDW is I don't have the licenses. And so, everything is a risk and everything is a shot in the dark that you're hoping lands. And if it doesn't, you're like, well, that hinders my ability to do the next one. And so, you're trying not to create from a point of fear or caution or what is more of a vanilla way to appeal to people. Because again, you never know. And then you also, that's not what I want to be doing either. So it's like everybody is trying to figure out that the way to just keep doing the stuff and keep the lights on.
Yeah, I think the first time, ironically, of all the goofy examples, the first time I became conscious of that premise was probably in an interview with Burt Reynolds in the 80s when he was saying, look, you know, half the movies I do are adult contemporary comedy dramas that are very good and very classy and very funny. And then I do the car chase movies so that I can afford to do smart, interesting movies every other movie. And then you got to do a cannonball run to get to, you know, the end or starting over or, you know, something that will actually get a good review. He's like, but if I don't do the cannonball runs, I can't do starting over with Jill Clayburgh.
That's why I find guys like James Tynion really admirable, because James was smart in that he was writing a really successful Batman book, which was a success because all Batman books are to some degree a success. Like his book was a good version of Batman, but I think he was savvy enough to know that I'm building my name off of this licensed book or this, you know, work for hire title. I'm going to stick with it as long as I can until I can really launch myself as a writer of other smaller titles that people care about. And so I think doing the work for hire work, and David, you do that too. You know, you do the work for hire work that then allows you to do things like Drawing Blood with Kevin that finds a big audience because people know you from doing these other things. And so I think the people that are sort of smart and savvy enough about realizing that the big corporate work is what's going to enable you to build a more sustainable body of independent titles is a very smart thing to do. And so,
and also look, none of us, myself and Burt Reynolds, we don't hate doing Cannonball Run.
Of course. Yeah. You know,
we're actually having a really good time making Cannonball Run. So like it, Elvira is the opposite of drudgery for me. It is great fun, and I love the fans and love working with her and all of that. And, you know, look, we got into this to be creators, but to a certain degree, we also got into it to play with the action figures. We also got into it.
100%,
You know, like I'm not the world's most gigantic Batman fan, but I write on a Warner Brothers show called Batwheels. And the first time I opened a document and did character name, Batman, and wrote a line of dialogue, I went, that's actually pretty cool. You know, I wrote a bantering scene between Batman and Catwoman. I'm like, I've been prepping to write that scene pretty much my entire life. So that's pretty, you know, like I've been aware of those two characters and their relationship since I was 5. So that's 53 years ago. I saw my first Batman flirts with Catwoman sequence. And so it is always fun to do that stuff and again to see it as being in service of everything else you do. My father once said, you know, one word for, out of every three words you write, one for truth and beauty and two to put food on the table.
Yeah. Well, and I go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Rylan.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
I was basically just going to agree, like, doing the work for hire stuff or writing characters that you love, like, is a huge part of what I think we all enjoy. Like, I'm actually doing some work for hire stuff right now for a character that's been around, like, before my lifetime, but certainly been in my life as a comic book series my entire life. And it's just so much fun. And so, yeah, I think doing both, you know, finding ways to sort of pay back the stuff that made us fans as kids. You know, I'm doing these different Marvel archival books for places like Abrams and Simon and Schuster. And so it's pleasing 10-year-old me who is a fan of that stuff.
Yeah.
And then also enabling me to do sort of the more obscure stuff I want to do. So it's, yeah, I love all of it, really.
And to be part of that tradition, there's a book someone put out a few years ago called 100 Years of Zorro. And there's two covers of comics I wrote in it. And I kind of love that if you pick up the history of Zorro now,
part of the Zorro history,
you got to see, you know, my name's in there in the back. And that's exciting stuff. There's a current Kickstarter for a Planet of the Apes role-playing game that I wrote on a little bit. And my dad wrote the novelization of Beneath a Planet of the Apes. And that kind of like, and again, I saw Planet of the Apes, maybe I was 6 years old when I saw that movie. And it's, you know, to be able to write the characters that impressed you so much when you were a kid is always an amazing thing. But, you know, there are people who get into comics and all they want is to write Batman. And I feel a little sorry for them because one, everyone wants to write Batman. And two, like, but don't you got nothing of your own? You really not one new. Okay. You know, like it's a different thing.
When I broke into the film business, because I won the final draft Big Break competition like 100 years ago. And that was stolen just from, you know, I was at AFI at the time, and, you know, just go from film student to suddenly everybody wants to talk to me. And that was pretty interesting. And one of my prizes was that I got to spend a day with Sid Field. Yeah. And so he gave me his home address, and I just drove up there and spent a day with him out by the pool and drinking, you know, he roasted coffee, and it was just such an interesting guy. And so we're drinking this like highly caffeinated crazy coffee out by the pool, and he gave me this advice where it was like, because I was having this, you know, I am I came up in this I came up in the Sundance movement, so I saw Fiction, quoted Pulp Fiction in the intro today, didn't plan that, but I saw Pulp Fiction, I said I want to do that, right? And then I moved out to LA. I went to the American Film Institute Conservatory, where David Lynch went, and I got my snooty film director's education. But by the time I got spit out into the workforce, like, they stopped making those movies, right? And suddenly it's like, hey, you know, polish the dialogue in this Fast and the Furious movie. And you know, again, I'm not complaining about it. I love Fast and the Furious. Give me Ludacris and Tyrese all day long. I'll yuck about that. I was at that time, you know, as this scared 22-year-old kid or whatever, I was like, oh man, Sid, I just don't know if I can do this or not, you know? And Sid one told me, like, hey kid, like, you know, get a grip, like, you're getting paid to write movies. Great advice number one, like, don't complain about ever, you sound like an asshole. That is maybe the best piece of advice. The second best piece of advice I ever got was, okay, you have these things you want to do one for them, and then do one for you. Do one for them and do one for you. And that's what I've tried to do my entire career. And it started out with movies, where it's like, okay, well, you know, yeah, I'm gonna rewrite this Fast and the Furious movie, but I'm gonna do this weird film that takes place on a Greek island with Fernando Treba and you know, getting paid a quarter of my rate because it's sold. And then it got really hard to find soul food in the film business. And so the comics then became the one for me, right? It's like, okay, well, I do need to take this crappy rewrite job to keep the lights on. Not complaining about that because I get to write movies. However, I now need to find a way to tell stories I want to tell in the way I want to tell it. And comics has always been here. So, So yeah, I just think that's interesting. And so I think about that every once in a while, that Sid telling me, do one for them and one for you. And I think it's, I think that got loaded onto my hard drive very early, and it's the reason I'm still doing this, probably the reason I'm still sane. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, when the one you're doing for them is the thing that you also love, it just makes it like, I've been talking. Yeah. In fact, I'm surprised it's taken me so long to bring it up today, but, I've been talking about my love of ROM Space Knight forever, you know, and then Marvel asked me to write the introductions for their big new omnibus collections. And so, like you were saying, David, like having my name now cemented in an even more official way with that character is just one of those things that, like, you don't do it for the money, but you do it because it does kind of just, like you say, just lock you in with a thing that you've always loved. And there's just something so special about that. And I mean, there's also something about that certain publishers will occasionally prey on that fandom, you know? And so people will take gigs because they like it so much, or they know that they've got to give in because there's 500 other people that are waiting to write Batman if they fall out of line. So
that Zorro thing that I mentioned earlier, literally the lowest page rate I've ever taken in my life. and when they they told me the page rate before the character, and in my head I went, well, this is going to be the easiest pass in the world. So what's the character? And I thought they said some old pulp character. I thought it was going to be the Black Bat. Like, I thought it was going to be the Green Llama. I thought it was going to be some like bullshit I didn't care about. And he was like, well, it's Zorro. And I went, I got it right. Zorro, man. But I decided not to do a second series. I'm like, I can't, you know, literally can't pay my rent on this kind of page rate. So that's gotta go. But I'm glad I did it. You know,
I mean, check the box and move on.
Yeah. Get to scratch the itch, but just don't have too many itches if you can help it.
And again, don't let them take that much advantage of you, that, you know, you keep feeding the beast and it's doing fine and you're not. That's the publisher didn't go out of business, but I could go out of business. So let's not have that.
But well, it's like they say, like the golden handcuff thing, like the handcuffs at least need to be made of gold, you know?
Yeah. Right. Right. Exactly. No, I always, even when I was, you know, primarily doing film, I always used to say, I'm kept just successful enough not to give up.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Not successful enough to be comfortable, but just successful enough to not give up. And like Ryland, comics absolutely, I've only been doing, this year will be my 10th anniversary of meeting Joe Riband at San Diego and him offering me a shot. And comics absolutely saved my soul when indie film had just burned me to a crisp. The last editing job I took, I had told my wife, I think I'm retiring from it and I'm going to focus on writing full time. And I said, well, an old pal asked me to edit this film. And she's like, oh, I've seen this movie. You're telling me about the one last bank job you're going to pull in Mexico. And then you'll never have to do it again. And I said, yeah, this does end with me dead on a bank vault floor in Mexico, right? And that's
your Richard Stark novel all of a sudden.
It's
really good.
And ironically, that is exactly what that was a movie where I literally had to like hijack the footage to get paid from my old friend. So maybe I don't want to do this particular thing anymore. And then, you know, I've said this before, but the classic show business irony that didn't surprise me at all is that being a comic book writer suddenly led back to the best jobs I've ever had in film. Writing on Bat Wheels, doing development on the Red Sonja movie over at Paramount. Like, you know, they were impressed with me, like, you made independent films for 30 years for nothing. Who gives a shit? But you write comic books?
Well, it's funny because comics went through that years ago, right? When it was like the Bill Gemmis era at Marvel was like, we don't care what you've done. As long as you've done it somewhere else, we'll bring you in and let you write comics because somehow there's this perception that because you're successful in, I don't know, reality TV or radio or whatever, wherever the drawing pool was coming from is like, well, bring them in. They need to write comics because they know how to get attention and people love them and they've got a big following and it inevitably doesn't work if the love isn't there to start with.
And that's a, like, yeah. Kevin Smith is a perfect example of, like, well, no, that's a guy who probably on some level wanted to make comic books more than he wanted to make films, actually. Like, you know, like,
yeah,
all his films are about making comic books. Like, yeah, you just see it. Yeah, pretty, yeah.
Yeah. That is, it's not a giant leap to imagine that Kevin Smith might be interested in writing a comic book.
Yeah, and there you can see it from the start. You know, Edgar Wright is a comic book guy. Like, there are certain people that I shouldn't name names, but okay. Edward Burns, if you remember Edward Burns, who did like Brothers McMullen and other sort of those Irish family movies. Yeah. So he did this book for Virgin Comics back in the day. And I always cite this one as just like sort of the nadir of doing the kind of IP development, the Hollywood people trying to horn in on our turf. He wrote this book called Doc Walloper, which is like sort of a goon-like character that was working the docks and getting in fights, you know, back in the 1920s. And he wrote this essay that was in the inside front cover of the book. And it was like, I don't know what your silly little comic books are. I don't read them. I don't like them. But I'm told that this is the way to get my screenplay actually made into a film now. And so here you are. Here's my comic, suckers. And I was like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, nobody wants this so shit. Bad. Like,
that is, he actually admitted .gif.
It's like, oh man, hide that, at least pretend you like us, you know. Yeah. At least drop Watchmen and Batman Year One as your all-time favorite comics. Like, hit the buzzwords that other Hollywood people have learned to sort of cite as books they've never read but have heard were good, you know. He was just like, I just can't get this movie made, help me, you know. Like,
yeah.
So
God. Yeah, now there's people tend to approach comics with a great deal of contempt when they come in from the outside. They don't,
and comic fans know it. Like, we don't want you. Yeah. Like, go do your thing elsewhere. That's fine. You're great at making the kind of movies you want to make, but just leave us alone then. Like, we know how to tell comics because we love comics. And so
and you can't do well in an art form you have contempt for, because you don't understand it. You don't understand how it works. You don't, you know, I have repeated this advice 1,000 times because obviously, because of my career, I have screenwriter pals who ask me about, should I turn my script for my pilot into a comic book? And I always say the same thing. Are you going to love it as a comic book? Are you going to be really fucking excited to have a comic book? And if the answer is no, you're spending months of your life and up to $20,000 on a brochure for a television show that will never exist.
Well, that's the other way to make it go away, right? Is you go, well, you might get $80,000 or $140,000 or whatever to write this pilot. You're going to get $75 a page or $100 a page to write it as a comic. And they go, oh, well, okay, never mind.
Yeah, when I tell people, when I got my first, when I heard what the pay price was on Batwheels, my initial response was, that's what Warner Brothers pays you to write Batman for television. Yeah. But then I did a different kind of math and I went, yeah, it's 5 times more a page than I get to write comic books at my
height. Which is partly why all of us are so broken, right? Like, we all have these like inferiority complex because we're like, well, I guess $50 a page is all we deserve. And so anybody else on the outside offers more money, you're like, oh shit, there's a world out there where, and that's why we lose some great people, because, you know, it isn't sustainable for enough of the great talents in this business. No,
And you have to sort of, you know, I think this is true across the board in film, television, and show business. Unless you are an overnight success of some kind and an absolute outlier, you need to do more than one thing. You need to diversify. Oh, yeah. You need to be willing to make money from a variety of different pots. And, you know, you never know which one will hit. I always say it's the mark of the amateur is when someone says, I want you to read my treatment, my script, my whatever, but you got to sign this NDA. And I'm like, no, it's like if you have, if you think one idea is like, oh, this is it, this is the one idea, it's like, you got to have a new idea every 2 to 3 days, man. Like, or you're screwed.
Well, because every day you haven't heard back from somebody is a torture, you know. And so it's like, cast the thing out into the world, if something happens with it, that's great, but kind of forget about it or compartmentalize it and go on to the next thing. And because if you sit there just going, come on, this is my one shot, like, it's so hard.
I love writing Batwheels and I love being in the Animation Guild and all that, I did not write a single script in 2022 and for television. And I remember saying to my wife, thank God this isn't my whole life anymore. Because I would be devastated, suicide. But I published a dozen comic books in 2022. I made money doing development work for people. I wrote some, like, I did a dozen other things that weren't that while I waited for them to produce the season two episodes of Bat Wheels that I wrote. And now in 2024, they've come back with, oh, do you want to write something for season three? But there was a year in there of not doing the thing that if I had said, this is my thing, I'm going to do this now, I would have been devastated. It would have been the end.
Yeah.
You know,
that diversifying your bonds is just so important. And it was at some point, you know, maybe the smartest thing I ever did was I became a writer and not just a screenwriter. Right. You know, I became Miller stories and I mean, I, you know, again, I went to AFI with, you know, just a ton of writers, of creators that were much more talented than I was. And they worked at least as hard as I did. You know, I watched them all wash out over and over again. And, you know, we have hit some icebergs as a creative community. And I'm talking film and comics and everything. And with film, you know, there was the last strike, not we just had the strike before that, was a big deal. I mean, Hollywood completely remade the way they did business. Overnight, they're making about a third as films as they were, you know, the night before. Suddenly you couldn't sell an original idea to save your life and everything had to be based on IP. And there were just all of these and you know, this strike white people out in a dozen different ways. And, you know, at some point I just became, I'm like, I'm not just a screenwriter. I am a storyteller. So I need to find an opportunity to tell a story and then tell a story that suits that medium, that suits that audience. Right. And so I've published a bunch of short fiction, we have pandemic and then strike and you can't sell you can't sell a film, period. And comics is going through its own, crisis. And so those jobs are hard to come by. I wrote a novel that's being edited right now, you know, and it was where opportunity, where is the, what door can I knock on? And I think that is what kept me alive, where a lot of people that I knew that again, were more talented than I was. Probably. And they're just like, I'm a screenwriter. Why would I do that? Why would I do this? Why would I do that? Or if they get another opportunity, it's like you're saying, they're using it as sort of a backdoor way to get their film set up or something like that. Right. You know, and yeah, I think it's like, well, I know for me, I just have, my biggest worry is that I'm going to die with stories left to tell, you know, all these stories in my head and I can't get them out fast enough. And we are in a period of contracting opportunity in both film and comics and so yeah, it's like find a way, right? And maybe that way is Kickstarter and maybe that way is this, that, or the other thing, but find a way to get the stories out, you know, and then they can still become other things, you know. I mean, they may get turned into movies, but you know, the beauty is, well, I don't know, if I didn't start telling comic stories, I would, you know, there would be, I don't know, 20, 30, 40, you know, stories that I never would have told. And that's just already. And now my daughter, 50 years from now, on whatever the equivalent of Amazon is, can go on there and find the books that I wrote. You know, that's like a legacy thing. That's what keeps me going. You know, and it's weird that people don't take that opportunity. They don't make that pivot, but yeah.
Yeah. I think the only drawback to trying to sort of keep all balls in the air is just not getting so bogged down on the business end of it and the pitching end of it and the marketing end of it and all that. Like it has just become a more challenging world to be able to just do the writing, because now sort of have to be a cottage industry unto yourself, to some degree. So yeah, again, I think that's part of it, is just trying to find ways to do the work, but also promote the work, sell the work, like all those kind of things.
And the project management stuff. I mean, you know, specifically as an editor, you know that. Like, you know, I'm primarily a writer, but I spend a hell of a lot of time looking at art. you know, yeah. and you know, making changes, making suggestions. I mean, I have a pretty light touch in that sense, but even so, you know, I remember this as a film editor, like I would cut a film, and the first couple of films I cut, I just kind of like, here's the cut, and walked away. And I learned that even if they weren't paying me, if I didn't sit in on the sound mix, if I didn't sit in on the online, if I didn't sit in on the color mix, if I didn't sit in on the music scoring sessions, some of my work was about to be blown to smithereens by people I'd never met who didn't understand what was supposed to be happening in that shot.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
I cut a Dracula movie once that they had written a prologue that told the history of Vlad the Impaler, and they hadn't really shot anything for it, but they had gone to Moravia and shot a ton of statues and crypts and whatever. And I literally constructed the history of Dracula from video of statues and skulls and castles and whatever with very little material. And then they recorded an actor reading the narration. When I saw the rough cut of the film, I cut the film, gave it to them. They did an online. I sat in to watch the online one day. All of the narration happened over a period of 20 seconds and was followed by a further 2 minutes of silent shots of castles and statues. Rather than it matching the images, they just shoved it in the first 20 seconds of the movie. And I had given them a tape with a scratch track to go, no, this starts here, this starts here, this starts here. But they weren't paying attention. They didn't know. And I have learned through bitter experience, read the galleys, read the PDF, assume nothing, you know, assume that none of your work. It's like, well, I once did a thing that was like, well, this trade paperback is just going to be a reprint of the comics, and the comics were printed right. So I'm just going to look at the opening and the closing, and I'm going to make sure the page turns are right. The book comes out. 3 pages in the 4th chapter are missing half the dialogue balloons.
Oh yeah.
And none of us caught it.
We've had that happen. Yeah.
I didn't catch it. The editor didn't catch it. And I was like, how, like, just use the files from the floppies. How did the layers drop off the pages suddenly? But happens all the time.
There's a gremlin aspect to printing and publishing that, yeah, some stuff is just inexplicable. So the more you have a hands-on, or the more eyes that you have on a thing, like, it can help, but it can also hurt it, which is why I think comics are more pure for all of us, because it's a smaller team. So everybody seems more vested in the story they're telling. So you don't have to worry about too many different people on the film that might not sort of understand what you're trying to do with that opening bit.
Yeah, no, that part is absolutely true. I mean, the small size of the team, and it's like, no, I don't need 100 people to understand what I'm going for here. I need 3.
Yeah, it's like the money purity sort of
it's
balance you're trying to find.
And, you know, and also it means creative input from a smaller number of people, which you know, can take. It's easier to listen to the inker than it is to the craft service guy, you know, like, just as a general principle. Doesn't mean you shouldn't listen to the craft service guy. He might have a good idea, but the collaboration is a closer one, and no one doesn't have skin in the game. The letterer has skin in the game. The colorist has skin in the game. You know, they absolutely do. And you should treat them like they do. You know?
Which is why, like, deciding what licenses to do back in the day, the calculus was always, does somebody internally care about it? And do the licensors care about it? Or is this just a marketing thing for them? Because, you know, there's going to be that many more levels of approvals and feedback and everything that can really derail a book if they don't understand why they're helping make it. And so, I think, again, it all comes to sort of caring about what you're making, how you're telling the story, and who the audience is. And if you don't, somewhere along the way, people are going to sort of see the fact that you're just preying on their general interest in these things, but they'll be able to see right through the shallow reasons for why you're doing it. So I don't know. I try to approach everything with, like, if we love it, then it's going to translate.
I think that's absolutely true. And you can so tell when someone is like, I remember a writer pal called me up in the 90s and was like, what can you tell me about Wild Wild West? And I said, a lot, but why are you asking? He's like, well, I'm going in to pitch it tomorrow and I've never seen an episode of it. And I was like, don't.
Yeah.
or take me on as a co-writer and I will explain this franchise to you, which I enjoyed very much when I was a kid.
But you're like, hey, man, the best thing you could do is put a giant spider in the film. That's
Exactly. Yeah. Listen to Scott Rudin. Yeah. And go with that giant spider, but it's but that movie is transparently made by people who maybe haven't even seen an episode of the TV show. You know, like there were things that worked in that show, and the filmmakers understood none of them, were not interested in portraying any of them, and I can see where they got there because they made a very successful Men in Black movie that had nothing to do with the comic book, really. Yeah. Like, that took the general premise in the vaguest of ways, you know. And there is also, it's a very common Hollywood thing of the first one was a success. We don't, you know, we don't need the writer though. We don't need to bring back people who really understood what this was about, you know.
Yeah, I've been in so many of those rooms where it's like, I mean, I would get pretty selective about the, you know, I mean, you know, I don't know that I need to write White Noise 3. You know, I didn't quite understand White Noise 1, and so I don't think I'm going to pitch on White Noise 3. Nothing against White Noise. If you love White Noise, it wasn't my bag. We got to find our bags. But I would go into a room, and it would be a remake. It would be a property. And I would lead with, you know, I love this property. I grew up watching this, right? You know, I am invested in this. I love this. I love this for this reason. I love the episode back in 1985 when this happened. I know the name of, you know, Thomas Magnum's dog. I know this. And you lead with that, and you lead with that enthusiasm, and you're trying. This is why I'm the one to hire for this, and not the next guy that walk. And there is this attitude in Hollywood that I think is too prevalent, where it's like, oh well, he's too attached to the old stuff, you know, like, so we need somebody that knows nothing about the old stuff. Who's just going to come in and give us a good movie and a new movie and a hip movie or whatever. And I guess I understand that you don't want to be too married to what came before, you know, because you can get, you know, it can be crushing, right? That can, that can keep you from taking flight in certain cases. However, you know, knowing the material, having like a reverence for the material, having an investment in the material, I think makes everything so much, you know, better. And I think when things really, I mean, I love Cobra Kai, and I think they found this amazing balance with the Cobra Kai TV series, where it's like, well, I mean, I'm so protective of those original Karate Kid movies, and I love all of them. I love 3 maybe even more than the other two, and not everybody loves 3. It is like a holy text to me. And Cobra Kai series, while it's not perfect, but it is respectful in such a meaningful way to the original movies and the original property. And then it takes light in such a new and interesting way. You have these new kids that are doing new things and telling new stories. And that was such an amazing balance. And you do not that if those 3 guys don't come in and say, hey, these are our favorite movies of all time, and we are going to make the greatest love poem to them that has ever been made in our minds, but also we're going to do this new cool stuff. And that's what I think you have to find. And I think that Hollywood doesn't think that way.
Yeah, well, it's funny because you can really tell that when there's a hit, you know, it's like when they go to follow a hit, and Betrayed is such a fundamental lack of understanding of why something was a hit. Barbie was this generational movie, you know, and it worked because of the actor and the director and the story they were telling and the audience they were aiming at and all of these things. And so they go, man, Barbie was a colossal hit. Let's do Hot Wheels next. Like, no. It wasn't the piece of plastic that made Barbie something special. So it's not like anything that's in Mattel's filing cabinet is going to work the same way. Special thing that worked for a special reason. And the fact that you think the next toy will be interchangeable with that is just like, it's laughable, but also deeply depressing. Cause like, how are you guys, the guys making these decisions?
And it is that thing of like, Barbie is such a unique property. And it's like, how are you going to find someone who can comment in an interesting way on human society through the vehicle of Hot Wheels, literally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I think basically one shot at it was, you know, John Lasseter, and he already made cars. Like, someone's already done their love letter to Hot Wheels. It's a very successful franchise for Pixar. It's just not branded that way.
Or Fast and the Furious. I don't know that there's going to be a third car franchise in the same.
Bat Wheels, in its way, is a Hot Wheels TV. You know, it's kids like playing with cards. That is cars. Yeah. That is the basis of our TV show. So, the merits
of Hot Wheels aside, like, maybe Hot Wheels becomes a great franchise, but just that, like, your follow up to Barbie is to think that that's the way to go. It's just, it's not a direct line from one toy to the next.
Yeah. It's such a blunt instrument take. Absolutely.
Yeah.
They're not sitting there, you know, in the pitch meetings going, we're not going to make this movie unless someone comes in with a mind blowing reinterpretation of human society through the lens of toy cars. You know, they're not actually looking for the next Barbie. Like, they don't understand what made Barbie work. So they're not like, pitch us a Hot Wheels thing that does what Barbie did.
Yeah.
I think that's possible. I think a good writer, you know, could absolutely deliver an interesting sociological document built on Hot Wheels. You could maybe do a commentary on American car culture. Like, you could absolutely do a thing about, you know, sustainable energy versus fossil fuels. You could do a thing about electric cars, you know. So definitely there are, it is rife for that, but they don't know to look for that. They don't know,
like,
that
Transformers.
That's
Transformers,
the Barbie thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Transformers, like, the story and film merits aside, like, it was a hit. And so then Battleship becomes a thing. Like, anyway, I mean, you know, we could probably cite tons of examples of that in film and comics and everything, but it's always amusing and also depressing that, like, a lot of the people making these decisions don't seem to understand why they're in those positions.
And, you know, for all of the bad mouthing that the studio system gets, I feel like, you know, the five guys that started the film industry also had a deep desire to be accepted as artists, so they were often pretty good about, make the movie, I will leave you alone, and we'll have notes when we see a cut. But we're not sitting in dailies every day. We're not giving you notes on the script every day. We're not like, you're the artist, do it. And honestly, you know, one of the biggest things that comics has given me is I have never worked in a situation where I got so few notes, where there was so little useless. There's no one in comics who is got the job of, I got to justify myself by writing 8 dumb, meaningless things you have to change about your comic book. Otherwise, I'm out of a job.
I got to put my fingerprints on it. There's nobody that needs to go to drinks that night and be like, you should have seen that script before I had a hold of it. You know, that is the worst person in Hollywood. And I feel like every third person in Hollywood is that person. And I have not met that person in comics.
I feel like the editors I've worked with are more just relieved that the thing works and makes sense and someone can draw it. And it's one less thing they have to do. Meaningless notes that don't help anything. Like, you know, they just don't want to waste the time. Like, here's 3 changes just because I have to suggest something or I'm not doing my job. I haven't met anyone.
Well, that's why there was a period where that did happen a lot, especially at the big two, where some of the older creators that really knew what they were doing would run into these younger editors who would want to, like, sort of impose their will or prove that they're in charge by demanding these sort of unnecessary changes just as a way to make themselves sort of feel like a bigger part of the process. And I think now, like, the overhead runs so lean and the work is so just tremendously never ending that nobody has time for that sort of nonsense. So
Every editor is a little too overworked. And, you know, I have gotten ridiculous notes. The bigger the company, the more ridiculous and the bigger the notes are. But it's still, it never rises to studio
level.
Like, we don't quite have that. But we should wrap up pretty soon. But I want to hear, what do you specifically have in stores now, Chris? What's coming up now? What's available for the kids at home?
Let's see. Launching in June is crime comic with Owen King and Jesse Kellerman, who are both primarily known as novelists, although Owen has done little bits of graphic novels here and there. And he was his Sleeping Beauty's novel he wrote with Stephen King was translated into comics. But this is like, this is something sort of different than he normally does in his books, which he has kind of a more Thomas Wolfe-y sort of sense of humor and sensibility, or Dickens, you know, in, like in his last novel. The Curator was very sort of Dickens-like. This is like kind of an Elmore Leonard feel to it, like to its snappiness and its humor and everything. It's a series about a sort of down on his luck loser guy who learns, or he's been aware that he sort of looks just like this highly successful self-help motivational speaker. Through various circumstances, he assumes the guy's identity, and it creates so many more problems in his life and brings all these wild gangsters and other things into his life. And it's a ton of fun. And so it's those two of the writers, and Mariana Ignazi is the artist. And I, like I say, it's launching this week. In fact, I don't know when this goes live.
This will be Wednesday, the 19th.
So yeah, it's launching. It's launching today. And it's called Self Help. And we're launching. I'm doing a book with Ashley Wood. Well, it's Ash's book called Lore, but we're publishing that right now. We have a couple of things coming this fall, and so yeah, there's, like I say, there's not a heavy mix of books, but you know, one or two titles a month, and then supplementing that with things like I have a Marvel calendar book that comes out in October from Abrams, and a Simon Schuster Marvel book comes out in the fall. So yeah, like we're all saying, like just trying to do as many different types of things as possible.
I stumbled across that idea of choosing to impersonate someone and choosing the worst person in the world to impersonate. There's a Graham Greene novel called Across the Bridge. Where a guy who has embezzled $1 zillion is trying to escape into Mexico. He meets a guy on a train who's roughly his height and weight, kills him and takes his passport, and discovers that he has just taken the place of the man who assassinated the president of Mexico. it's such a great Graham Greene twist, and I used it in a movie I wrote once because I love that idea of like, oh, I'll take this guy's identity when you don't know enough about the guy's identity to know what a terrible, terrible idea that is.
So on the surface, you think there's this big, good-looking, successful guy, but yeah, behind the scenes, he's just a depraved lunatic, sort of surrounded by even more depraved, more lunatics. So it's a lot of fun.
It's a good premise. And where can people find you online, Chris?
I mean, I'm on pretty much every bit of social media at Chris_Ryle. I do a weekly-ish Substack newsletter called Tales of Sis Spence, which is again playing off our whole Syzygy thing. And so I talk about old comics, new comics, and things that are coming up through there. And so I'm pretty much everywhere I can be there is to talk about these different projects. So.
And Chris will be doing a panel with us if you're at San Diego Comic-Con Sunday morning at 10 a.m. We're doing a panel called What Editors Want. And we have Chris, we have my buddy Joe Riband from Dynamite. We have an all-star panel there. So that'll be a lot of fun.
Those are always fun panels.
Can't wait. Yeah, it'll be good. And it's the kind of stuff, like, not to break our arms patting ourselves on the back, but I don't feel like there's enough of that at Comic-Con. We always strive in our panels, like, we're going to tell you some of the ugly and beautiful truths that you will not necessarily hear from the more puff piece, rah-rah panels. We're going to tell you how ugly it is. We're going to tell you how hard some of this stuff is.
I also think, like, the business has shifted so seismically recently that I don't think I fully understand it yet. And so maybe six of us or whatever can get together and kind of sort through some of it, because, you know, I think there's a lot of rubble we're still digging through. And we kind of are we in, but where are we now and where are we going? I think that's such an interesting discussion.
Absolutely. And Ryland, where can the kids find you?
I am Ryland Grant on all forms of social media. Most of our audience is listening on Apple Pods. So that is RYLENGRANT. I always spell it because it's not a real name. My parents just kind of drunkenly arranged letters and saddled me with it. And so now I have to spell it for you. But yeah, like I said, Peacekeeper's coming at you very soon. New book announcement, a couple of movies in theaters. Go check out the go check out the social media and I'll point you at everything. But yeah, bring us home, Evelyn.
And yeah, I've got, I have a website, davidavalonifreelance.com. The freelance is in there because GoDaddy are just terrible. And so I'm easily found. This upcoming weekend, if you're in Los Angeles, I will be at Comics and Cocktails. You can Google that, that on Instagram. It'll be a fun group, sharing a table with Richard Fairgray. I am ashamed and proud to say I am actually the inspiration for the name of the event, because they saw a picture of me with a martini in my hand and went, you know, that's the kind of vibe we're looking for, right? It's Comics and Cocktails. Nice. One of the funniest fan interactions I've ever seen is that someone complained the image is the original Iron Man holding a martini, like from the cover of Iron Man number one. And someone said, you know, that's really insensitive. Tony Stark's an alcoholic. I'm like, well, let's hope he doesn't see this then. Yeah. Because that would be very upsetting for him, a fictional character that doesn't exist. I was like, come on. And back in issue number one, he still enjoyed a cocktail. Like, let's not, when he was wearing that armor, still enjoyed a cocktail. Yeah. He would also need a straw to get it through the front grill. So I'm not too worried about him at this point. But yeah, and coming up, I have Drawing Blood number 3 and the finale of Elvira Meets H.P. Lovecraft is number 5. There's another Elvira thing cooking up that I'm waiting for approvals on, and an Elvira original graphic novel coming, and Image is going to take us all the way to 12 on Drawing Blood, fingers crossed. So it should be good.
Love it.
American fun. Thank you so much, Chris, for coming on. It was long overdue. I'm glad we could have you. And
pleasure talking to you both. Yeah, this is great.
We'll see you all at the comic book store.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening, guys.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more Madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.